At the beginning of this session, we need to have a quick pop quiz, class. All right, gentlemen, three things you got to remember in order to be godly husbands. Are you ready? Here we go. Oh, come on, start better than that. All right, ready? In order to be a godly husband, got to be a... Oh, beautiful. Ladies, three things you got to remember. And I know the ladies always argue. Ours are harder. There are more turns. Well, I assume you're more intelligent. That's the idea. That's why they're a little bit harder. All right, three things you got to remember in order to be a godly wife.
Submission, suitable helper, selflessly reverent.
Terrific. Now we want to talk about... godly communication in the home. All right, in order to do this, let's grab our Bibles. Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 4. We're getting a lot out of the book of Ephesians this weekend. And we're going to be primarily interested in verses 25 all the way down through verse 32. And we want to teach you four biblical rules of communication. Four biblical rules of communication. All four are really good. Now, I want to start off by asking you the question here on the screen. Is this the type of communication that's in your home? This is the little comic strip, Why We'll Never Understand Each Other. What he heard. You're way too stupid to be trusted driving alone in bad weather. What she said. Drive carefully, dear. What she heard. It's your lot in life to stop whatever it is you're doing in order to serve my every need. What he said. Honey, do you know if we have any more AAA batteries? Maybe this is communication in your home. What he heard. I'm going to make you wish you were dead for the rest of the week. What she said. Tell me the truth, honey. Do I look fat in this? What she heard. Anything less than absolute perfection makes you an utter failure as a wife and a mother. What he said. Mom is coming over for dinner. Or this, what she heard, life as we know it will cease to exist unless you can alter the space-time continuum. What he said, honey, are you almost ready yet? Or this is my favorite one. What he heard, honey, why don't you put your head in a vise and I'll turn the handle until your skull explodes. What she said, honey, why don't we turn off the TV and just talk? Or finally, it could be this. What he heard. Your right to independent thought and ability to form an opinion has been revoked. What she said. I do. All right. So if that's communication within your home, then we certainly have problems that are going on. And you can't be in any kind of a marriage relationship without realizing that every relationship, no matter how good that relationship may be, experiences serious communication problems. Now, why is that the case? Well, good communication in the Christian marriage does not happen automatically. I think there are a lot of Christian couples that think that, well, we're both Christians, we both love the Lord, it's just going to happen, it's just good to us. I mean, I know that happens to other people, but to us, we're not going to experience the failures that other people do. That's the thinking of newlyweds, all right? Neither is the Christian marriage immune from problems. Why? Why? Well, there's several reasons. Because you and your spouse are sinners. That basically means that you're focused on yourself and what you want and your needs. Because you and your spouse are finite with sinful hearts. That means you can't see what's coming around the next corner. And because your heart has various cravings and desires that ultimately conflict. What is it that causes those fights and quarrels among you? Well, the book of James helps us to answer that. If you go over to James chapter 4, James answers the question, what causes quarrels and fights among you? And you think, at least according to modern Christians today, that his answer is going to be, well, it's because my wife is caloric and I'm phlegmatic. I'm melancholy, and my wife is sanguine. Or men are from Mars and women are from Venus. We have these just different personalities, and that's what causes fights and quarrels among us. And in reality, different personalities, there's nothing in Scripture that says different personalities causes these problems at all. Nowhere. In fact, in the Bible, personality is fluid. It's not fixed. Personality theory all came from Hippocrates. Hippocrates was the one who developed the Hippocratic Oath for medical doctors. And Hippocrates believed that your personality was rooted in one of four bodily fluids. A person had too much blood, they were one personality. Too much phlegm, they were another personality. Too much yellow bile, they were another personality. Too much black bile, they were another personality. And so he said, I can show this to you. If you have too much blood, you're probably a highly energetic, life of the party kind of person. Type, you're out there doing all kinds of things. If all you have to do, and he developed bloodletting, you just drain some of their blood, and guess what? This gregarious person turns into changes their whole personality. All right? Or if you're really kind of sad, emotional, moody, tend towards depression, then you have too much black bile. And he used to give them very powerful herbal laxatives. Well, if you've been sitting on the John for 4 or 5 days, everything looks up, changes your whole personality. All right? Everything is different. Proof positive, it's located there. Well, we would never say that today, obviously. But the Latinized terms came from that. Blood, sanguine, phlegm, phlegmatic, yellow bile, choleric, black bile, melancholia. All right. And most of your personality tests, your Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis test, your MMPIs, your Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventories, and the various versions of that particular, are based upon that fourfold theory that somehow people are these fixed personalities, and that's the reason why they conflict. But that's not what James says in James 4. That's not the reason why there's major conflict. Why? Why are there conflict? He says here, is it not that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and you cannot obtain, so you fight and you quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. In other words, James says it has nothing to do with personality. It says it has everything to do with desires that are in your heart. He says, and you murder. I don't think he's saying that the Christians were literally going around murdering each other. He's using murder in the same sense that Jesus did in Matthew chapter 5 when he talks about the fact that the heart of a hater and the heart of a murderer is the same heart. It's just one has acted it out and the other one hasn't. If you hate in your heart, you're as bad as a murderer. It's just that a murderer hates in their heart and they've acted it out and they've killed somebody. If you come to Los Angeles and experience the terrible traffic we have in Los Angeles, all right, well, you go to the automobile stores and they have these little things you mount on your dashboard and they have little buttons on them and you get stuck in really bad traffic where it's hot and you're on the freeway and there are just thousands of cars in front of you and behind you and around you. You can start pushing some of those buttons. One of them is entitled missile. And another one's a machine gun. Another one's a grenade. So you can sit there in your car on the freeway and be blowing up the cars in front of you, figuratively, destroying them because they are in your way. Okay? That's ritualistic murder. That's not real murder. But Jesus says the heart of a hater and the heart of a murderer is the same heart. It's just that one has acted it out and the other one hasn't. So this is what happened. You see, our desires conflict. You have a desire, your wife has a different desire, and those desires conflict. They conflict. You want something, and your husband wants something different, and they clash. And as a result of that, our hearts begin to hate. Hate the person,
You may argue, oh, no, I just hate the conflict.
But in any other case, you desire and you do not have, so you murder figuratively, ritualistically in your mind. It's like the husband and wife who have a major conflict before he goes to work in the morning, and he bolts out the door, slams the door, jumps in the car. She's standing there washing the dishes. She's thinking to herself, I hope he has a horrible day. All right? That's malice. That's hatred. And he's driving to work, in and out of traffic, swerving in and out of traffic. He's thinking to himself, I hope the children make her life horrible today. Well, there you go. Those desires that conflict and cause problems. Major, major problems. Your heart has cravings and desires that conflict. That's the real problem. It has nothing to do with your personality. I'm not the same personality I was when I graduated from high school. I tell all of our students, you ought to be happy about that. I'm different. I'm a different person. God has changed me. That's what we call progressive sanctification. People change over time. Good marriages and loving relationships can be built by couples who are committed to being God's kind of husband and wife. There's the hope there. If you take to heart biblical principles of communication, you begin in your marriage, you begin to improving immediately. But you've got to be sincere in your desire to do things God's way. That means he defines what is best for your marriage, not you. This is where Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 32 comes in. It's really key. He's the one that defines what is best in your marriage. You're not the one who defines that. He's the one that defines it. This is really key. In other words, the preceding context is really good here in properly understanding that, because in the preceding context, he talks about Ephesians chapter 4, picking up in verse 22, three prominent Greek infinitives here. The first one is to put off. The second one in verse 23 is to be renewed. And the third one in verse 24 is to put on. We have to put off the old sinful habit patterns and the old sinful thought patterns. This is where change really comes from. We've got to do that. And then that's what we call an active middle aorist in the Greek language. It means we ourselves are responsible for stopping the sinful things that we say, the sinful things that we think. We have to stop doing that. And then it says be renewed. And this is aorist passive, which means God is the one who does the renewing. We don't. We're passive in it. God gives us a renewed, rejuvenated outlook on our problem or on our spouse. We're be renewed in the spirit of our minds. Verse 24, and then put on, now we're back to the active middle aorist where we ourselves are responsible for putting on. So we put off, God renews, we put on. That's why from our perspective we often say that permanent change in the Christian life is always two-factored, and then God gives the renewal. We put off and we put on. You don't really change until you put off the bad ways of thinking, the bad ways of acting, the bad ways of speaking, and you haven't really still changed until you put on new ways of thinking, new ways of acting, new ways of speaking. You have to do just as much work putting on. Sometimes I teach it like this. Years ago, kids used to say, when is a door no longer a door? When is a jar? That's right. All right. When is a door no longer a door? When's a jar? We can use that as a paradigm. When is a liar no longer a liar? A lot of people think a liar is no longer a liar when he stops lying. When is a thief no longer a thief? Thief's no longer a thief when he stops stealing. No, that's just a thief between jobs. All right. When is a sexually immoral person no longer sexually immoral? When he stops being sexually immoral. No, that's not what it says in the text. When is a person no longer a liar? When he begins to speak the truth. That's when he's no longer a liar. When is a thief no longer a thief? Well, verse 28 here says, Ephesians 4, 28, when he begins to work with his hands, he He says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with someone in need. So when he begins productive instead of taking from other people, he's actually producing for the needs of other people. A thief hasn't changed until he's put on the productivity. Is the idea. So you're getting this idea that permanent change is always two-factored. You haven't really changed if you've just stopped doing bad things. You've got to replace that with good things. Until it's a brand new habit. And a habit has three characteristics. It's got to be automatic, unconscious, and comfortable. You haven't really changed until you've put on new habits that are automatic, unconscious, and comfortable. Those three things are key to putting on new habits. New habits of thinking about your spouse, new habits of speaking to your spouse, new habits of doing the right things for your spouse. That's when change has occurred. Now, with that said, let's talk about four rules of communication. There's a lot of change that needs to occur here, and you're not really changing until you've put on. You stop the bad words, bad behaviors, bad thoughts, and you put on good words, good behaviors, good thoughts. Four rules of communication. Rule number one, look at verse 25. He says, therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are all members of one another. Rule number one is be honest. Rule number one is be honest. What do we mean by that? Well, he says speak. The Greek term here is in the imperative, laleo. You speak up with the truth. Why? Because people cannot read your mind. People cannot read your mind. Which tells me that when people have conflicts, when a husband and wife has conflicts, usually one or both parties just clam up. So nothing gets resolved. And clamming up at this particular point is not an option for the Christian. It's out. You have to speak. In other words, excuse me, being honest is much more than just not telling a lie. You have to speak up with the truth. That's really important. You have to speak out with it. Oh, you're reading my mind, Matthew. Thank you very much. So, this is not a time during a conflict to just clam up and withdraw. That's just as sinful as anybody who says bad words or says bad things. Clamming up and withdrawing does not accomplish or solve anything. You have to speak, he says. Then he says you need to speak truth. That's important. What does he mean by that? Speaking truth. Speaking the truth is a verb that involves continual action. It's in the present tense. Something that should continually be a part of our lives. It's to be your new lifestyle in your marriage. David said, you must speak the truth from a heart of integrity. Psalm 15:2, not deceptively or with disguised, hidden, or double meanings. That is a person of integrity. We speak the truth. Not only must we speak, but we've got to speak truth. Now, why is that so significant? Here's some examples of the way that you may be dishonest in your speech. Well, outright dishonesty, a deliberate lie, falsification, or denial of the truth is, of course, blatant dishonesty. And sometimes you may tell a lie because you think it's in your best interest to do that, tell a lie. That's never an option for God's people. There are incongruities where your speech is inconsistent with your halo data, that is your nonverbal communication. That's when we say such nice things in such wicked ways. It's like the husband who in counseling is asked, do you love your wife? And he says, I love her. Now, if you were to send her a text message with the exact words that he said, It would, isn't that nice? Look, he told her that he loved her, but that's not the message she got. Because non-verbally, the opposite came across, right? Communicologists tell us that 93% of all communication is in the non-verbals. In terms of the meaning of communication is in the non-verbal. So the way that he rolled his eyes, the way he used the tone of his voice, his whole inflection was saying, "All right, if I have to say it, I'll say it. I love her." All right? So sometimes there are incongruities where your speech is inconsistent with your nonverbal behavior. Your tone of your voice is nonverbal. Your eyes are part of your non, your gestures are part of your nonverbal. Sometimes when what you say conflicts with the way that you say it, then you're lying. That's falsehood. That's how deceptive the human heart is. Or there's disguised communications like innuendos, insinuations, implied accusations. The human heart's incredibly clever, especially in its sinfulness. We can say things and imply things, and then our spouse will say to us, "Are you implying that?" And we leave just enough back door for us to slip out the back door. "Oh, no! Is that what you think?" But we certainly implied it. That's lying. That's the same as lying. Sometimes I'll say to couples in counseling, "I'm not going to let you sit there and sin all over my office. We're not going to do that. Stop that. Stop implying things that are not true." You see, honesty is more than just not lying. It's being open and honest with the truth. You have to be open and honest with the truth. It is an attitude of the heart that you adopt. Colossians 3:9, "Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices." Don't lie to yourself. Don't lie to others. That's not the way in which a Christian is supposed to act. A Christian is supposed to act with integrity. Psalm 15. That means we speak up. That means we speak the truth. But now, I want you to notice this. Paul has already said up in verse 15 that we're supposed to speak the truth in a very specific way. What are we talking about here? We're supposed to speak the truth in love. What does that mean? Sometimes people can be brutal with the truth. In other words, we use the truth like a sledgehammer to beat somebody into the ground with it. "Oh, I told her the truth." Well, it may have been that he did tell the truth, but he did not speak it in a loving way. Speak the truth lovingly. If you speak the truth in spite and in anger, then you are not doing it in a loving way. If you speak the truth without forethought concerning the person that you're speaking to or about, then you're not doing it in a loving way. Christians are to speak the truth with the other person's best interest in mind. In other words, when I speak the truth, I have your interest in mind. I'm not just trying to unload this off my chest. I want to speak it for your best interest. Wow, that's phenomenal. I love Colossians 4:6. "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each other." And notice how gracious speech is equated with salt. Why the equation? Well, in ancient times, salt did exactly what salt does today, and that is it creates thirst. If you've ever gone to a Major League Baseball game or a major stadium game of any kind, and they have concession stands, those concession stands are full of salty foods. Popcorn, peanuts. Why? Why do they feed you salty foods? So you'll buy drinks. All right? It makes you want to buy drinks and spend more money. I'm thirsty. Well, gracious speech is like that. Gracious speech makes people want to hear more. You heard the young farmer say to the old farmer, "You're going to lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink." And the old farmer says, "That's true, but you can sure salt his oats." All right? Yep. You can sure salt his oats. What is gracious speech? Gracious speech is the kind of speech that is so nice. I mean, even though you disagree with your spouse and your spouse knows you have a different opinion, but you've stated that disagreement in such nice terms that they are thirsty to hear more. It is an art of gracious speech that only God's people can really do in a genuine fashion. You season your speech with grace. Even though you disagree, you don't see eye to eye on it, but you say it so nicely. They say, I want to hear more. I want to hear more. Bring on more. So first rule of communication is be honest. Second rule of communication, I want you to take a look at verse 26. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. Rule number two is keep current. Rule number two is keep current. In other words, it's possible to be angry. Maybe your husband or wife has done something that is genuinely wrong. And you're angry over what they've done. And you're righteously angry. It's not an unrighteous anger, is very self-centered anger. But righteous anger is centered in on what God wants and the welfare of other people. And maybe you're righteously angry because your spouse has done something wrong. But even righteous anger can turn to unrighteous anger if you allow it to ferment. Don't let the sun go down in your wrath, is the idea. All anger is not sin. Self-centered anger is. When you let your anger ferment, you don't deal with it. I'll never forget, I was talking to this couple that was having marital problems, and the husband kind of leaned back in his chair and he says, "Well, then we're going to move to Alaska." And I looked at him and I thought, what? Went right over my head. And his wife caught on before I did. "Well, you know how in the summertime the sun shines 23 out of 24 hours. And back up the train." I did give him points for creativity. But no. It's not where we wait as long as we can until the sun starts to dip down on the horizon and then we finally deal with our anger. No. This means, it's a colloquialism in the first century, and the men deal with your anger as soon as you have opportunity. That's what it meant. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Don't save your anger to the next day. Try to deal with it that day, if at all possible. It's very creative what he said, but it doesn't work. Don't buy it. Why? Why is that so important? Because failure to solve each day's problems that day means you're, number one, guilty of sin. You're holding on to your anger. You're guilty of sin. Number two, you open the way to resentment and bitterness later on. Because when you're holding on to righteous anger, you're not really dealing with it. Then you become bitter and resentful in your own heart towards that person, which causes you to distort subsequent problems. This is what we call gunny sacking in counseling. Gunny sacking. You know, gunny sacks are what hunters used to carry around many, many years ago. Big burlap bags. They go out and shoot a rabbit or shoot a bird, throw it in their bag. They out hunting all day long, fill their bag up with game, take it home at night, slaughter the game, prepare it, that kind of thing. That's what people do with problems. They gunny sack their problems. You can't see the gunny sacks, but they're there. All right. Their husband or their wife does something. They don't deal with it. They just throw it in their gunny sack. The next day, they do a couple more things. They throw that in their gunny sack. They throw four more. And pretty soon, this gunny sack is getting bigger and bigger, and they're hauling this thing around there, all these unresolved issues. And then one day, their spouse finally does something. It may be very, very small. And they decide that is the day that they're going to pick to empty their gunny sack. And they empty it all out all at once. And their spouse is there going, whoa, what is the problem? And they say, it's not what you've done, it's who you are. That's the problem. What? How could they say that? Because they have this entire spiritual gunny sack that they have carried around all for a long time. Who knows? Maybe it goes back years. All these unresolved issues, and it's just now more than they can take. When a person does that, then every problem that comes along is distorted. You're looking at those problems through colored glasses. You're looking at those problems through colored glasses. And everything that they do is wrong. Failure to deal with that day's problems that day. And it endangers your physical relationship. We'll see that later on. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Why? Well, because nobody wants to go to bed with their problem. Nobody wants to have sex with their problem. When that person becomes the problem, nobody wants to go to bed with their problem. And so that then opens, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, that opens a foothold for the devil in their marriage. When that comes to an end. So number one, be honest. Number two, keep current. Number three, I want you to take a look at verse 29. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouth, but only such as good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear, and do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Rule number three is this. Attack the problem, not the person. Attack the problem, not the person. Why do we say that? Because unwholesome words, the Greek term there means corrupt or rotten words. Unwholesome words zero in on the person and their character. They tear down and demolish the other person. They are words like, you always, you never, you turkey, you dummy, you idiot, you stupid, you dumbbell. And those are just as bad as curse words. We tend to only label curse words as unwholesome, which is a very narrow definition, but God's definition is much broader. We have a very definition of things that are unwholesome or rotten communication. We think taking God's name in vain, using curse words, and it is, that's rotten communication. But God's view of rotten communication is so much broader. Why is that? Because it's anything that tears another person down. Doesn't have to be a curse word. You don't have to take God's name in vain to do it. You just tear them down. We never let our kids say, you always, you never. That's 100% language. Is that true? They always? No, that's not true. They never? No, that's not true. You idiot? No, that's not right. That's attacking them. It's not attacking the problem. When you turn your attack upon the person, that's not edifying communication. That's not edifying communication that builds that other person up. You turn your attack upon the problem, not the person. Those are unwholesome words. They accomplish absolutely nothing. But edifying words, those are the ones that build up. That's attacking the problem. These are the words that focus on the problem. They are selected in order to make it easy for two people to find a solution. They're solution-oriented words full of graciousness, as we saw in Colossians 4:16. They always have your partner's welfare first and foremost in your mind. Statements like, I disagree with what you've done, but I'm open to hear your side of the story. Wow. That may cause your partner to start sucking air. I'm willing to hear your side of the story. You never said that before. Or, I want to find a solution to our problem that will be best for you and our home. Now, your partner's heart's starting to beat really fast. What in the world? Who are you and what'd you do with my spouse? Or, I want to work on this with you so that Jesus Christ is honored in our marriage. Now your partner's in full cardiac arrest. All right? Who are you really? Those are edifying words. Those are words that are meant to build up in the midst of a difficulty, build up in the midst of a problem, not tear down other people. When you tear down other people, that gives Satan a foothold and it grieves the Holy Spirit of God. That's what verse 30 says. It grieves God's Spirit. So there's three rules of communication so far. Be honest, keep current, attack problems, not people. The fourth one is in verses 31 and 32. Verse 31 says this, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ has forgiven you. So be honest, keep current, attack problems, not people. Number four, act, don't react. All the reactions are verse 31. All the actions are verse 32. Reactions to problems are bitterness, which is perpetual animosity that leads to harsh and unloving opinions about other people. Wrath, which are outbursts of passionate rage. Anger, a subtle, deep flowing type of anger. Clamor, outcry and shouting. Slander, speaking evil in another person that comes from some kind of set of indignation. And you may say, well, you know, I'm not bitter, wrathful, angry, clamorous, or slanderous. That's not me. Well, then Paul throws in a thing that is a big blanket that covers a lot of stuff. Then he uses the term malice. What is that? That is a general wishing of ill will towards someone else. That's what, when the husband and wife has that conflict in the morning and she's standing there at doing the breakfast dishes and thinking to herself, I hope he has a horrible day. That's malice. He's thinking as he's weaving in and out of traffic on his way to work, I hope the children make her day miserable. That's malice. That's a general wishing of ill will towards someone else. We're supposed to get rid of that. That doesn't belong in the Christian life, nowhere in the Christian thinking. Not at all. That's not proper for God's people. Instead, there's three key things that you need to put on. You get rid of all that. You get rid of that, but you haven't really changed until you put on. Permanent change in the Christian life is always two-factored. It's not enough to just put off. You got to put on. What do you put on? Well, you're kind. That is, you're useful, worthy, good, benevolent towards your spouse. You're tender-hearted. Literally, it means having healthy bowels. In the Bible, they're the seat of emotions and attention. Therefore, it means to be compassionate with your partner. You're kind, you're compassionate, and you're forgiving to exercise grace in relieving the offense of your spouse, releasing it. This includes the willingness in the heart. Mark 11:25, and the verbal granting of forgiveness when repentance has taken place. Luke 17:3-4, which includes both attitudinal and transactional forgiveness, which is key there. All of that is important in communication. Four rules of communication. Be honest, keep current, attack problems, not people, act, don't react. Oftentimes I'll teach those in counseling, say to the husband, I want you to keep copious notes because your assignment is to go home and teach this to everybody in your family so that they fully understand it. That's your job. Mom, it's your job to take this and go home and display these four rules all over your house, however you want to display them. Some women print them up on their computer and display them. Other women go to great detail. I've had women cross-stitch the four rules of communication, put it in a big thing, and put a frame around it and hang it in their living room. Be honest, keep current, attack problems, not people, act, don't react. The bottom line is, everybody in the household is going to live like this. And it is amazing how the attitude of that household begins to change. And they're also very, very clear about when they have failed, because then they ask forgiveness of one another.
all right, I'm going to prop you. Everybody look at me. Four things you got to remember to be a godly communicator in your home. Number one, be, keep, attack, act. Very good. They passed the quiz, Pastor. Break time. No more problems. All right, we take a break.
Yeah. A few minute break, guys. We'll come back.